This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, nearly a million Black people waste away in U.S. prisons, which still house political prisoners from nearly a half century ago. Some young activists have begun a prisoner letter-writing campaign to let them know that people on the outside support them. And is the current anti-Russian hysteria worse than during the Cold War? We'll ask the author of a book on the anti-Russian madness.
But first, the Green Party has watched with interest as a number of Democrats have taken positions well to the left of Democratic Party leadership. In New York, Green Party candidate for governor Howie Hawkins says if you want real social transformation, vote for the Greens. Hawkins and other Green Party members recently announced support for social ownership of the economy, a state public bank, and other radical measures. We ask Howie Hawkins what he means by social ownership of the economy.
Well, we mean economic democracy. If it's in the private sector, it should be a cooperative where it's a worker cooperative. The workers get the full fruit of their labor. In other words, what would go to profit to the owners would be shared among the workers according to how much they worked. And if it's a consumer cooperative, after it's supposed to operate at cost. And if you have money left over at the end of the year, you give a patronage dividend to the patrons in proportion to how much they bought through the co-op. So that's in the private sector. In the public sector, and a lot more things should be in the public sector, you have democratic public enterprises where boards are elected by the people and are accountable to the people, and they operate at cost for public benefit, not for private profit. And that's the basic idea. When we talk about socialism, I always like Rosa Luxemburg's old saying, there's no socialism without democracy and no democracy without socialism. And if you have concentrated wealth that translates into concentrated political power, so you really can't even have political democracy in a capitalist system because that power is concentrated in the hands of the ownership class. So that's what we're talking about. We came out when we announced saying we want an ecological socialism, got an ecological crisis, and we got an economic crisis. And the funny thing happened in the last few weeks, some of these Democrats who are running for office, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got a lot of attention. She was endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, calls herself a socialist. And now even the Clinton girl, as she described herself, Cynthia Nixon, who's running for governor, told the Democratic Socialists that she at least shares the values of socialists. And then Jemani Williams, who's running for lieutenant governor with her, piped in and said, me too. So we said, okay, well, we did a news conference last week and said, all right, what is socialism really about? It's not just that everybody should have the basic needs, which is part of it, but how do you do it? And that's where social ownership comes in. That's a central tenet of the socialist tradition. And since Bernie Sanders ran for office, he explicitly said, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about things like single payer health care and tuition-free higher education, which are good programs, but it's not socialism. Those are the old New Deal type modifications of capitalism. But the problem is the capitalists still have all that power because the wealth is so concentrated and they can roll those things back, which they've been doing in recent decades. So a funny thing happened on the way to the election, a big discussion of socialism broke out here in New York.
Yes, you know, it wasn't too long ago when a call for social ownership of socialism of any kind would be met with derision. But we now see that polls show that majorities of millennials are friendly to the word socialism, and an even bigger percentage of Black millennials and Black folks in general.
Well, it's certainly part of the Black radical tradition anyway. Martin Luther King, I mean, his love letters to Coretta were about socialism, even though in that time, I mean, I grew up in that time. It was the McCarthy era and the Cold War. And so in the 60s, we called ourselves radicals to distinguish ourselves from the liberals because we wanted to go to the root and get, you know, structural change. But the word socialism was too much of a buzzword. But it's changed in the last couple of years. And I think it's great because now we can start talking about real solutions to pressing problems.
How is the word socialism greeted in the broad ranks and the leadership of the Green Party?
The Green Party has been moving that way in recent years. They passed a plank to the platform that talked about ecological socialism and economic democracy 2 years ago. And, you know, I think a lot of the rank and file Greens are developing their understanding of the root causes of our problems. But what people like me who've been socialists all our lives are saying is, look, you got two fundamental problems with capitalism. One is competition drives blind, relentless growth that's destroying the environment. So you can't have a sustainable society if it's capitalist. And secondly, the polarization of wealth and income is made worse every day because you go to work and you only get part of the value you produce, and the other share goes to the owners. And there are fewer owners than workers. So there are lots of workers making a few owners very rich. And that's a normal operation of capitalism we've seen since the so-called Golden Age fell apart, which was a compromise after World War II. And that's what capitalism renders. So those are two fundamental problems that people are concerned about. And if you want to solve them, you got to go beyond capitalism. And that argument, I think, is taking hold among most of the Green rank and file.
And the ownership of almost everything in this society ultimately is private finance capital. But you guys are calling for the establishment of a state public bank in New York.
Yes. If you look at New York and the share of income going to the top 1%, in 1980, it was 12% of all income. Today, statewide, it's 30%. And in New York City, it's grown from 12% in 1980 to 41% today. And then you look at, well, how are they getting so damn rich? It's really through what's called the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate. In other words, the rent is too damn high. The land values and property values go up. They use that to collateralize and borrow money. So it goes to the banks and the landlords. And so part of our program is it's time to tax the 1% again and use that money to invest in revitalizing the public sector, both the services and our crumbling infrastructure.
But please elaborate. How would a state public bank work?
Well, it would bypass Wall Street and the Federal Reserve System. So you don't have to pay all the finance charges, all the interest, all the commissions to these Wall Street banks when you go bond to do infrastructure. Instead, you deposit the state's money in that bank, and then you lend it out, and the interest comes back to you. So basically, when you do infrastructure through a public bank, like the Bank of North Dakota has done for 100 years, it's about half the financing costs of doing it through the bond market. And then it's publicly controlled, so you can prioritize what are we investing in. And then the people have a say, whereas Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or Morgan Chase, we have no say in what they invest in. So it gives us more democratic control and direction of where we're going.
Yes, in California, there's a huge movement towards public banks. But part of the impetus for that is there's so much marijuana money sloshing around with the legalization of the trade. That doesn't exist in New York yet.
Yeah, but all the politicians are finally jumping on the bandwagon, and the states around us are doing it. So I think it's coming to New York. The problem is the banks that are in the Federal Reserve System and are federally chartered don't want to touch that cash money from the marijuana trade. So the whole business is cash where it's been legalized, like in Washington and Colorado. So that's one thing a state bank can do. It can provide financial services to that industry. And in fact, the City Council of Los Angeles just voted to put a referendum to the people of Los Angeles to set up a municipal bank. And the biggest impetus was just the medical marijuana industry they have there. That's all this cash sloshing around, and they want to service it. But, of course, once you've got a municipal development bank, you can invest in a lot of other things cities need.
But, of course, New York is the center of private banking capital in the country, if not the world, calling for a public bank to compete with that huge center of capital. How's that play in New York?
Well, with the people, it plays well. You know, with the banking class, of course, they don't want the competition. I mean, if a bank is providing cheaper terms of credit and is investing in things that the other banks don't want, they're not happy. I mean, they would rather see the public sector go into debt and then privatize the infrastructure so they can set up toll booths on it and make money off of that too. Whereas if we have a public bank, we can keep that infrastructure in the public sector. So they have a lot of reasons to oppose us, but, you know, there are more of us than there are of them. So the 1% can be outvoted.
Yes, there's more of us than them, but they are concentrated capital. And about the most concentrated capital in the world, besides the banks, is big energy. But you guys are calling for expanded public ownership of energy.
And that's another one where I think the people understand. We have 50 municipal power, public power companies scattered among towns and villages across upstate and 8 rural cooperatives. Plus, we have the New York Power Authority, which runs the hydro dams. So people are familiar with it, and they know, or we will point out to them if they don't, that the public power utilities provide power much cheaper than the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities. So I live in Syracuse, New York. Our rates are 4 times what the rates are next door in the village of Solvay, and Solvay is filled with factories because electric costs are something that, you know, affects manufacturing. And meanwhile, in Syracuse, we're under National Grid, but the people call it National Greed. So when the bill comes, you know, my greed bill came. That's the way people talk about it. So I think it's popular with the people. Again, the people got more votes than these giant utility owners.
In most of the country, public housing has been all but destroyed. In New York City, however, 700,000 people live in public housing. So there is a real and continuing presence there. What do you propose in terms of public housing?
Well, 2 things. First of all, the New York City Housing Authority is falling apart. They haven't been investing. There's mold. There's lead. There are elevators, boilers that aren't working, roofs that are leaking. They need $25 billion just to bring the units they have up to where they ought to be. So that's first. But beyond that, one of the reasons the rent is so high is there's so little affordable housing. And basically, government stepped back from public housing back in the early 1970s. And it's more expensive to build an affordable unit by subsidizing a private developer than it is to build it directly. And I think we should learn from Europe. They have public or social housing, as they call it. And in some cities like Vienna, it's 60% of all rental housing. And in a country like Germany, the rent is 10 to 15% of income, whereas in New York State, half the people are paying over the federal affordability standard of 30% of income. And a quarter of them are paying over half their income for rent. So there are not enough affordable units. The subsidizing private developers hasn't worked. So we need to go back to public housing, but do it right. The old public housing was big projects, segregating and isolating poor and minority people, and it created problems. What we need are high-quality, mixed income. That's what they do in Europe. So you got poor working class and middle class people all living in public housing. It's quality, should be human scale, scatter site, and powered by clean energy. So we see this as not just an affordable housing program, but a jobs program, a desegregation program, and a clean energy program. So that's where we want to put a lot of money in because the rent is too high. And people, we have a homeless problem, and it's no longer the people that got mental or drug abuse problems. It's regular working people, especially single moms. And they can't afford the rent, and they're living in shelters or out of their car. And so we got to build affordable housing. And public housing is the most economically efficient way to do it. And if we build quality public housing, it should be something that any community would welcome as an asset.
You saw a need to bring some clarity to this discussion of socialism in this country and maybe to the issue of single-payer health care as well.
Yeah, it's real close in New York. The state assembly has voted for it 4 consecutive years. Our with count in the state Senate is 1 vote short. Governor Cuomo has said it's a good idea, but he didn't do anything about it, didn't put it in his budget or his State of the State address. But we have momentum there, so we're definitely pushing that. Now, as a socialist, I remember the debate back in the 70s when you had the Nixon bill, which was kind of the Romney-Obama, you know, mandate for private insurance. And then you had the Kennedy bill, which was a single-payer national health insurance program. And then you had the Dellums bill, which came from the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which was patching up, you know, medics and doctors who patched up people who got beat up in the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement. And they came up with the idea of a health service, where in addition to the insurance being social insurance, socialized, the delivery would be socialized. So doctors would be on salary. They wouldn't be entrepreneurs. And the thing that we were concerned about back in the 70s was there was an article I never forget because it had a great title. It called National Health Insurance Single Payer the Great Leap Sideways, because they were worried the drug companies and the for-profit medical providers would just be eating at the trough of this social insurance program. So it would be an even better way to control costs. And the only place I know where they've done a study where single payer always comes out cheaper than any of the mandate programs and so forth. But in California, they added a health service as well, and it came out cheaper than the single payer. So at this point, since there's so much support for single payer, we want to get that bill passed and see how it works. But the health service is where socialists would really like to go. And the other thing I liked about the Dellums bill was, instead of like our single payer system as proposed in New York, you have a board appointed by, you know, top elected officials like the governors, and they administer the whole thing. In the Dellums bill, you had districts to administer the medical system in their district, local districts, and those boards that would govern the system were elected by the general public, and then a minority would be elected by the workers who deliver, you know, the health providers. And I think that kind of democratic accountability is what we need when we have public enterprises. So that's a pitch for the Dellums bill, which Barbara Lee kept introducing until about three Congresses ago. So it's right now just collecting dust on the shelf, but it's something I'd like to see come back.
Some black folks might look at this press release and say, well, where is there any attention to the special, historically oppressed, the needs of the black community?
Well, when we talk about going to 100% clean energy by 2030, we actually have a bill, and I've been campaigning on that three governor's races. Now we have a bill in the Assembly and the Senate, and among its other provisions are what we call just transition, where the communities and the workers affected by the transition are made whole. And then there's targeted investments. Their climate justice is required, and that would target some of the investments for the communities most in need. So we're looking at that. The public housing, and also we're talking about the schools. We have the most segregated housing of any state in the nation and the most segregated schools of any state in the nation. And it's definitely an issue of race. It's also an issue of class. And so we want to have equal opportunity, equal access for all the people to things like energy, healthcare, and education. So in terms of what we need to do, what we need to do is find common ground in our common class interests while making sure we deal with all the special oppressions that black folks or other people who come from certain groups face. Because if we don't do that, we're not going to be united as a class, and we'll be divided, and the owning minority will stay in power.
In this environment of anti-Russian hysteria, it's difficult to even talk about peace. But certainly none of these domestic social transformations can occur with the kind of military-industrial complex and expenditures that we're seeing.
That's certainly the case. That we're squandering, as Martin Luther King said when he turned against the war in Vietnam, at a time when Johnson thought he was also fighting the war on poverty, he said, we're losing the war on poverty in Vietnam. And that basic dynamic has continued to this day. I mean, I did a news conference yesterday about lead poisoning of our children. In 1971, the Surgeon General issued an urgent warning that all the children needed to be tested. And if their blood levels of lead were high, they needed to be treated, and the source of the lead needed to be remediated. And here we are 46 years later, in my home city of Syracuse, is the lead poisoning capital of the United States. 40% of our children have more than the 5 micrograms per deciliter that the Center for Disease Control and Prevention says is the threshold. 40% of our children. Now, Syracuse is worse, but we have a big scandal going on in New York City because the Public Housing Authority was basically lying to the feds on their reports about what they were doing about lead. And then, you know, de Blasio said, oh, only 19 kids are poisoned, but he was using the state standard of 10 micrograms, which the feds, you know, said was too high several years ago. So when they counted with 5 micrograms, it was hundreds of kids. So it's a big issue right here in New York City right now. It's also a big issue in my home city. In fact, our city lost its federal funding for lead remediation because our city was lying to the feds on what they were doing. So the feds pulled the funding. So that's all to say that our priorities are really screwed up. We're spending always money for military stuff, but our children are being poisoned. And, you know, when you get lead poison, it affects your intellectual development, your motor skills, and your behavior. And it's just a bad way for a child to start out, and it's just inexcusable. It's a crime that we've let it go on this long.
And how do you think your campaign's doing? Is it catching fire? Would you have a prediction to make about the outcome?
No prediction. I think what I do know, there have been some polls come out, have us between 2 and 5%. We got 5% last time. We know from the green vote statewide over the last several elections, we have a hardcore vote of 100,000. That's double what we need to keep our ballot line. The question is, can we reach those progressives and even socialists who are Democrats or independents and point out to them that we are the only party that's independent of this corrupt two-party system? I mean, we've got, and just to talk about the corruption here, we've had a bunch of Cuomo's top aides get convicted, you know, this pay-to-play problem. We had the majority leader of the Senate, a Republican, just get convicted again for extortion. The Democratic House Speaker has been convicted for bribery and kickbacks. And so we need a clean government, and we need to be outside this corrupted two-party pay-to-play system. So hopefully we can reach those progressives, and they'll recognize that if you want to get out of this corruption trap and failure to deliver what our basic needs, you got to get outside the two-party system, and that's where the Greens are. When we come in the fall, we'll be the last progressive standing.
That was Green Party candidate for New York Governor, Howie Hawkins.
Democrats and war hawks reach for ever higher heights of anti-Russian hysteria, ascribing near superpowers to Moscow and its president, Vladimir Putin. All this is deja vu for many older Americans who remember the Cold War days when Russians were thought to be under every bed. In a new book, Jeremy Kuzmarov and John Marciano explore the similarities and the differences between the current anti-Russian madness and the hysteria of two generations ago. The book is titled, The Russians Are Coming Again. The first Cold War as tragedy, the second as farce. Kuzmarov explains.
The title comes from Karl Marx's famous book, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. He was discussing tragedy of Napoleon and the tragedy of Louis Napoleon III in France. I think what we're seeing, a farce, you know, the second incarnation of Napoleon was a farce. So my analysis is, yeah, to kind of apply Marx to the Cold War. I mean, the first Cold War was a great tragedy. It resulted in millions of deaths, proxy wars, the diversion of our spending away from human needs. But what we're seeing now playing out is a farce, because in the first Cold War, I mean, there was some semblance or some reason at least to fear the Soviet Union given the abuses of Stalin, although my book generally shows that, you know, Russian threat has constantly been inflated historically. In the current era, it's just ridiculous. I mean, Vladimir Putin is popular in Russia. He's led to improvements in Russia's economy. Russia is fairly weak militarily at this time. They're claiming he's an aggressor in places like Ukraine and Syria, but if you look into these conflicts, that's kind of a ridiculous claim. So there's really no reason to fear Putin or Russia at all at this time. And all of this is just kind of manufactured hysteria. And it's really just kind of playing out as farce. We see the Democrats we're supposed to be a party of, you know, civil liberties and human rights, adopting McCarthyist tactics. And I think that's part of the farce. We see, you know, one of the key people lobbying for the new Cold War is William Browder, who's the grandson of Communist Party leader Earl Browder. He became a, you know, he rebelled against his family by being a hedge fund billionaire and looting Russia of money. And he's has a personal vendetta against Putin, and he's spreading a lot of stories about him. So that's part of the farce as well.
Yes, back in the old Cold War, at least this was a clash between two different social systems. But both the U.S. and Russia are dominated by oligarchs today.
That's right. And there's no real base. I mean, Putin is more on the conservative end, and he's not really hostile to the West or the United States at all. He's repeatedly supported cooperation. In fact, I think in Russia, some people have been pressuring him to take a harder line. So where is the threat? I mean, the Cold War, yeah, you had an ideological clash that emerged. So some of the allegations, at least, against the, you know, communist regime, like as far as the abuses of Stalinism, and, you know, as far as the spying, I mean, that was greatly overinflated, the number of spies that the Russians had in the United States. And most of the spying occurred in World War II when the U.S. and Russia were allies. However, there were at least a few genuine spies like Klaus Fuchs on the Manhattan Project. So there was at least some reality behind some of the allegations.
Yes, and in fact, in Russia today, Vladimir Putin has to cope with a very strong faction in ruling circles that are called the Atlanticists, the ones who want to align Russia's future with that of Western Europe and the United States.
Well, that's correct. Yeah, and I think there are also hardline elements in Russia who don't want any cooperation and want more military spending than Russia has already providing, because the Russian military budget is like one-tenth that of the United States. So there are factions in Russia kind of pressuring him to spend more on the military, to intervene more aggressively in Ukraine. You know, and that's the irony, is that the media here is presenting this major aggressor in Ukraine. But in Russia, you know, there are elements who want a much more stronger Russian presence there because they feel the Donbass struggle is a just one and that the Ukrainian military is oppressive and dominated by neo-Nazi factions.
Well, Victoria Nuland, Hillary Clinton's main person at the State Department on Europe, Victoria Nuland bragged that the United States dedicated $5 billion to promote a color revolution, a regime change in Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think that's at the heart of the misconception. I mean, we hear the big lie repeated over and over again, Russian aggression in Ukraine, Russian aggression in Ukraine. I think people just believe something when it's repeated over and over again, and they don't actually look into the facts. I mean, the Ukraine crisis originated because of a coup d'etat that occurred in February of 2014 that was provoked by the United States, yeah, which was trying to get, you know, neoliberal elements in power in Ukraine and pry Ukraine away from the Russian orbit. And that's what precipitated the crisis, because the peoples of Eastern Donbass were more oriented towards Russia. They're Russian speakers, and they wanted to break away from the Ukrainian military. And having read into it, actually, there was a proposal. The whole crisis could have been averted because Yanukovych, the deposed pro-Russian leader, had actually accepted a proposal that would have alleviated the crisis that was going on in Ukraine and allowed for elections to proceed. But it was rejected by the right-wing forces in Ukraine, and they forced him to flee for his life and basically orchestrated a coup d'etat. That's what triggered the conflict in Ukraine. So it's not historically accurate to blame Russia for being the aggressor. And also the struggle in eastern Ukraine is supported by most elements of the population. So Russia can't be an aggressor, but it's just repeated over and over again. All these allegations against Russia are continuously repeated, and it's drumming up this anti-Russian hysteria.
And we should point out that it was during this period of the coup in Ukraine and the rise of Nazis in Ukraine that Hillary Clinton so famously called Vladimir Putin Hitler.
Yeah, I think that's part of the just overblown rhetoric we see that's very dangerous. And that's part of this kind of post-fact universe that's not just true among Trump supporters. Unfortunately, it's quite broad among the spectrum of elite politicians and those who support them. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, yeah, I think that rhetoric was used with regards to the seizure of Crimea. But again, Crimea, the situation there is similar to Donbass, where the population is more oriented to Russia. There's a large Russian ethnic majority there, and they voted to rejoin Russia. So there were all these claims against Putin that he was this great aggressor, and the Hitler comparisons, I think, were starting at that time. And it's very dangerous.
You were speaking of the power of repetition. In today's farcical Cold War, we see that even though there is no hard evidence that the Russians actually were the ones who filched the DNC emails, we are told by corporate media repeatedly, there is evidence and there is more evidence and here's some more evidence, when none is forthcoming.
Yeah, and I think part of the farce is the intel. They constantly claim the intelligence community, has established that Russia hacked the election. However, when the intelligence community had the chance to present their evidence in January 2017, they presented a report. The report was a farce. Anybody who looks at the report would laugh at it because the report had no evidence. It didn't even show that there was any investigation. Half the report was an attack on RT News Network as an alleged propaganda organ of the Russian government. And there was no evidence in their own report. And they acknowledged that they had made an assessment, which is just a kind of guess because they didn't present any evidence. So the intelligence agencies themselves have not presented the evidence to convince any objective observer that that hack took place. And then the Veterans of Intelligence for Sanity group, headed by Ray McGovern, undertook their own study and hired an IBM specialist in computers. And he determined that it had to have been based in the mainland of the United States based on the speed of the modem and communications. And so his assessment was that it was an internal leak rather than a hack. And that's never been addressed. That study by an IBM expert has never actually been addressed or mentioned in the mainstream corporate media. So something is very, very fishy here.
Certainly, we are in unprecedented times with former CIA officials and members of Congress and television personalities calling the sitting president of the United States a traitor. We haven't seen anything like this since Andrew Johnson, the successor to Lincoln, who was impeached.
Yeah, I think it's part of the farce. I mean, you have basically conspiracy theories from the 1950s that were dismissed as the product of lunatic groups like the John Birch Society that accused Dwight Eisenhower of being a communist. Now you see that in the New York Times, in New Yorker Magazine, all these respectable liberal outlets, people who are supposedly respectable are adopting these far-right, what used to be far-right-wing conspiracy theories. I thought it was a travesty because I read through the transcript of the meeting and I thought it was a constructive meeting that Putin and Trump had, for addressing some of the genuine issues that the two countries have to deal with. For instance, Putin was urging for the abiding by the Minsk peace protocols in Ukraine, which has a viable prospect for ending the fighting in eastern Ukraine. So that would be something very constructive. And Putin also had various proposals. He even agreed to cooperate with the Mueller investigation if the United States would cooperate with investigations of American citizens who carried out tax evasion on Russian territory and robbed Russia of money. And I think that was actually a sensible proposal. So I think it's good that two leaders, the United States has had many summits in the past with Russia, even during the heart of the Cold War. So it's just crazy that they're going crazy about this, two leaders meeting when that's gone on historically and when there are a lot of important issues to address. And there's a lot of ways the two leaders could actually come together to solve some problems.
Yes, you had to read the text of the press conference in order to find out what was going on because the corporate news media did not report by and large on anything that happened in Helsinki except the Russiagate related story.
I find it totally unprofessional. And I've been watching CNN, and they've just been obsessed. Like, I don't know if they call themselves legitimate media outlet, they're not engaging in journalism because they're not reporting anything. It's just 24 hours incessant attacking Trump as a Manchurian candidate and bringing on guest after guest who says the exact same thing. It's just not journalism. And they weren't covering the issues. So the American public is left completely uninformed about these important issues that two countries have to resolve, including the issue of arms reduction treaties and the need to renew the START treaty that's expiring in a couple of years. That's of vital importance for all of humanity, that we have a deal in place that will regulate and limit the use of nuclear weapons. That should be the forefront of discussion. But I think all this hysteria is undermining prospects of détente and cooperation to solve these vital matters.
Many of us thought after the brouhaha about Russiagate had gone on 6 months into 2017 that it inevitably would slow down, that the momentum of this hysteria couldn't be maintained, but instead it's increased.
That was my thought as well, and I thought a lot of the public was seeing through it, and the strategy of the Democrats is backfiring. But it's hard to tell now. I mean, I think the media has been so incessant. And yeah, the point I was saying, if you repeat the big lie enough times, you do start to believe it. There is a historical parallel for that, some ugly historical cases. One could look at World War I and the demonization of Germany that led to U.S. involvement in World War I. So unfortunately, that's what we're starting to see. I mean, I think public opinion seems to be aroused from what I've seen about this issue. It could be leading in a very scary direction, and the undermining of détente at a critical time in U.S.-Russia relations.
Well, of course, powerful forces have a deep and abiding interest in keeping this hysteria going. The Democratic Party, for example, as an institution, but also the national security state, the intelligence services.
Absolutely. I think the war on terror is kind of winding down. It's lost its luster. The so-called threat of terrorism has receded. And most of the public is tired of the war in Afghanistan. You know, it's gone on for years and years. So how do you justify sustaining what appears to be about, I mean, if the official military budget is about $800 billion that Trump escalated, but the real figure is over $1 trillion. So how do you justify that? You need a new bogeyman. And they picked Putin. You know, Putin is somebody who has stood up to some extent to the West and, you know, made Russia a more stronger country. And that threatens certain U.S. interests in the region. And they've picked on him, and now they're just going with that. And they're using the media to brainwash people.
In your book, you talk about some heroes of the old Cold War, Henry Wallace, who was vice president under FDR, and Paul Robeson and W.B. Du Bois and people like Woody Guthrie. But we don't seem to have too many heroes in this farcical Cold War.
Yeah, well, I think there are heroes like yourself. Stephen Cohen is a hero. You know, he's been speaking out. He's an academic who studied Russia for many years, and he's presented a very sensible analysis of Russia, and he's been warning about the Russian hysteria. So I think there are left progressives like Robert Parry, who unfortunately passed away, but Consortium News has provided a counterbalance to the mainstream media. Unfortunately, these kind of individuals are marginalized, so they're not very well known to the broader public. So yeah, I think we need more like celebrities to step up. You know, Woody Guthrie and Paul Robeson had backgrounds as celebrities, musicians, so they had a certain voice and stature because of that. And yeah, we need more mainstream politicians. I mean, where's Bernie Sanders on this? You know, Bernie Sanders is in some ways like the Henry Wallace of this era, very progressive politician, you know, who is leading a revolution in some sense, away from the corporate tyranny we live under. But he's been very weak on this issue, and I think some of his statements seem to play into some of the anti-Russia hysteria. So that's very disturbing, and that shows Sanders may not be of the caliber of Henry Wallace, who was, you know, a great American political leader, who unfortunately was railroaded and was a victim of McCarthyism.
Isn't the corporate media and the Democrats and the others that are behind whipping up this hysteria, aren't they in a sense fouling their own nest. They talk about threats to U.S. democratic institutions, but in fact, their hysteria is harming those institutions.
I think so. I think it's harming the integrity of the media, because the media's job is to go out and get the story and talk to people, expose the public to different viewpoints, provide probing investigative journalism. They're just completely failing to do that. So they're kind of feeding into Trump's claims about fake news, and that's leading the populace just to become totally cynical and, you know, disengaged, or to support his brand of right-wing, you know, populism. So that's very, very dangerous. And yeah, they're eroding democracy because they're leading public policy in a direction that increasingly empowers the military complex, who have destroyed effectively American democracy. I mean, we've seen a slow military coup basically take over this country, and they have so much political clout, all the money they have that they use for lobbying and to buy off politicians has effectively destroyed democracy. So this is just leading in the direction of further empowering the military and other special interests who have destroyed functioning democracy in the United States.
Yes, in this very weird period, we have black folks whose politics was considered quite left now acting like the CIA and the FBI are their champions.
Yeah, I think that's very disturbing. Firstly, like with the intelligence agencies, I mean, they have a history, just a very recent history of deceiving the public, like with regards to the WMDs in Iraq. So we should be very suspicious about those agencies. And yeah, those are the agencies that have created a kind of nation, you know, mass surveillance state here in the United States, and also, you know, police state to a large extent. So, you know, agencies should be not viewed as having great credibility or integrity, and are a threat to functioning democracy.
Well, is there light at the end of this very noisy, insane tunnel?
Yeah, insane is a good word. I really have found it to be insane, because when I watched it, I thought that it was, and I'm not at all a supporter of Trump, I never thought I'd even be defending him. It's just, I think that was one decent thing he did, to meet with Putin, and it was a step forward. And to see the reaction to this have found to be very, very disturbing, especially in some of the rhetorics that's used about a new Pearl Harbor and treason and appeasement. You know, these are words of war and could very much lead to a war. And that's what scares me. So I think now it's important for the progressives to come together and to speak out about this, to try and educate and reach our fellow citizens to avoid a disastrous course.
That was Jeremy Kuzmarov, co-author of the new book, The Russians Are Coming Again.
This past weekend, social justice activists in New York City set in motion a letter-writing campaign for political prisoners. Marlene Nava-Ramos is an organizer with Critical Resistance and a doctoral candidate in sociology.
We put together this event after an event that the campaign to Femumia and a few other organizations put together, I believe, BYP 100, as well as IWalk and Jericho New York put together. And we wanted to put together a much more intimate event where we had an opportunity to meet each other and collaborate. We originally came together at a sanctuary church in New York City in Washington Heights that for almost a year now has been housing and providing sanctuary to a woman from El Salvador who is fighting her deportation proceedings. She's been in this country for a few years. She has two U.S.-born children, and she now faces the threat of deportation. And under this new regime or presidential administration, she felt it necessary to be able to fight for herself, fight for her children. So this event around letter writing came primarily in response or as a follow-up to that event that happened a few months ago. And we wanted to sit down and have a conversation about political prisoners, as well as broader conversation around mass incarceration. And you know, originally we wanted to have Amanda there, the woman who's currently taking sanctuary, so that we could also continue to connect the dots between immigration enforcement, immigration detention and deportation, and the larger movement that we have seen in this country around mass incarceration. So in doing a letter writing night, seemed naturally for our chapter and as well as the other organizations who participated. Critical Resistance has been developing an extensive male night program. That's also our volunteer night. Every month we get together, you know, anywhere ranging between 10 to, on some special occasions, we've even had 20 volunteers come over and help write letters to people who are imprisoned. Many of them are asking for a copy of our Abolitionist, which is a newsletter that comes out on a semi-quarterly basis. But other folks are also asking for additional literature or just resources. So we get together with a lot of volunteers to come and support and make it happen. More recently, we've been meeting at the Silvia Rivera Law Project, who's an amazing organization, and they have been very generous to lend their space. So doing a letter writing night seemed like a very natural direction for us and very much in line with the work that we're doing. We want to build relationships with people on the inside and connect the organizing that's happening on the outside with the organizing that's happening on the outside. So we thought that this would be a good space and also to begin to collaborate with other organizations whose work we appreciate and we support.
You mentioned the sister who is in sanctuary up in Washington Heights, Amanda. And during the event that you mentioned where she spoke of feeling imprisoned within that space on certain levels, given that she's not able to exit, do the various things that we do and take for granted on a regular basis as far as just going outside. How would you relate this current struggle around sanctuary and migration and refugees as regards the U.S. and question of political imprisonment?
Yeah, Amanda, you know, when she spoke at the event a few months ago, she gave a very brief contribution, but when she spoke, they were very powerful and also very emotional. And I remember her saying, and I can say it in Spanish, but she said something along the lines that, you know, me siento que estoy en una prisión. So I feel like I'm in prison in this church. And at the same time, she was also showing a lot of gratitude and appreciation, and she understood that she was indebted to Father Barrios and the entire sanctuary community that had made her stay possible, because it's the only way in which she's able to fight for her deportation case. But it really moved me, and I think that it also encapsulated what we see happening throughout the country, and it's not just the individual case of Amanda or the cases that we've been seeing on the news more recently. They are very much part of the prison industrial complex, at least that's the perspective that Critical Resistance has. And that in order to, actually, I'll connect this to something that someone said last night. None of us are free until all of us are free. And I think that at least for immigration enforcement, this is very much the case, whether jail or prison is built because it's meant to house people who are going to be funneled into the jail and prison system because of local policies, or because we have a detention center that's being built that's going to be funneled into imprisonment because of anti-immigration legislation. The infrastructure is the same. And in fact, when we think about federal immigration enforcement, the majority, and if not all, of the infrastructure, that the physical infrastructure on the ground has been built and is being managed by local jurisdictions like the NYPD or like the DOC. These are the facilities that are policing and imprisoning people on a normal basis. And really all that the Federal Immigration Enforcement Agency has to do at this point is identify them once they're in the system and funnel them into immigration detention and eventually deportation. So in some ways, immigration detention and deportation are at the very end of immigration enforcement. All of the steps that are required beforehand are laws that criminalize individuals, police that police immigrant and communities of color, and that eventually imprison those individuals. And what we have seen over the last 30-some years is that, I mean, it's actually very easy to criminalize an individual and target an individual regardless of the actions that they do. So oftentimes it doesn't even have to be a serious activity. It could be something very simple, like driving without headlights or something like that. And at least in Critical Resistance, we think that when we're fighting for immigration justice or when we're fighting for anyone in general, we have to go for the big fish and rather than trying to fight under a banner of innocence. So it's not about fighting against the fact that you have some individuals that are innocent or not deserving of being in jail or in prison, but it's about fighting a system that disposes of people and that sees imprisonment as the only solution to what we see on a daily basis, right? So right now we live in New York City. We're in one of the most expensive cities in the country. Rent is ridiculously expensive, and you have people who are constantly being pushed out of their neighborhoods through the process of gentrification. And with that, you know, is the invitation to be constantly policed by law enforcement. So these issues are interconnected. We can't just look at policing as an individual issue that stands alone. And other organizations like the Coalition to End Broken Windows have been really good at making these connections and also calling out decision makers at the city levels for hiring youth cops and even increasing law enforcement without providing necessary resources. You know, we should be hiring more teachers instead of police.
Yes, and to continue with the event yesterday and the freedom fighters who were highlighted, the MOVE women, Janet and Janine Africa, as well as Nina Dros Franco and Alvaro Luna Hernandez, what was the motivation behind choosing these particular political prisoners, and what stood out to you and the other organizers about these freedom fighters?
So the motivation behind choosing the individuals who we wrote to had many purposes, actually. We had many motivations for writing to all of these individuals. On one hand, we wanted to make the event inclusive and invite individuals who might be monolingual Spanish writers or speakers so that they could communicate with someone on the inside who could read and communicate with them in Spanish. And again, with the hope that originally, at least, we were going to have Amanda at the event. And then the other motivations were also to try to link connections across different peoples. And in this particular case, you know, Alvaro was an individual who was very active in the Chicano movement, or in terms of the movement itself, he represents the struggle, the Chicano movement struggle that emerges. It's actually very much actually dependent upon all of the movement struggles that emerge in this country that were very much a part of and influenced by the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement and thereafter. And then the motivation of writing to Nina was that this was clearly the issue of Puerto Rico is something that's at the forefront or should be at the forefront of all struggles at this moment. We have Puerto Rico, who is basically operating under colonial relationships to the United States. And here was an individual who was fighting for her country and to fight the colonial ties that it maintains to the United States. And if I remember correctly, during the May Day demonstration and the general strike that was being called last year during the incident when she was arrested, people were protesting in front of the building of the individuals that are making the decisions to keep Puerto Rico indebted to the United States. Right. So while the elite or the individuals in power in Puerto Rico could decide to choose a different path for Puerto Rico, they're keeping Puerto Rico indebted to unfair financial ties to bankers here in the United States. So I think that it made a lot of sense that people like Nina and Nina herself were out there and protesting and calling for a general strike. And that's why, you know, we wanted to have a moment to talk about that. And then the MOVE women have been very inspirational to the work of the Campaign to Free Munia and the other organizations who were there, and think that we should continue to write to them even though we couldn't communicate in Spanish, but we should include them. 2018, it's a 50-year anniversary since the peak of the civil rights movement in some ways, and we wanted to also think about an intergenerational analysis or a cross-time analysis of the struggles that people in this country have had to forge. The individuals we ended up writing to were chosen because they could communicate in multiple languages, because it was intergenerational, and then it also dealt with one of the pressing questions I think that not just Puerto Ricans, but everybody in the United States should be grappling with.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.